soon they shall be mine. And when she stopped singing, they said, no, no, and they applauded.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar in Southeast Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have an opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election, and final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the election will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online voting is open now through the annual meeting at kboo.fm/board24. Paper ballots may also be requested. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting and board election on September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board24.
Welcome to the Talking Earth for August. The Talking Earth is America, if not the world's longest-running radio poetry show here on KBOO Portland. I'm Dan Raphael. My featured readers today, wherever you are Kelly Lennox, Deneen Berglund, and Michael Keefe. I'll throw in a couple poems from Diane Seuss and Eileen Tabios. KBOO is free-range, non-commercial, community-powered radio, and you are part of that community as you're listening. Communities are two streets, two-way streets, and while you get our programming, we'd like to get a little of your money. A good percentage of the money we need to pay utilities, staff, etc., comes from you, our donors. Check out the website, kboo.fm, to see how you can help. My first reader tonight is Kelly Lennox. Kelly writes poetry and prose from her home in Milwaukee, Oregon. Her first poetry collection is The Brightest Rock. Kelly also writes a publication called Mama Ephemera's Muddy Feet, brief lyrical essays that she publishes each month on Substack, kellylennox.substack.com. Her work has appeared in Poetry Daily, Black Warrior Review, Timberline Review, and elsewhere in the U.S. and Europe. In her day job, Kelly is a science news editor for Environmental Health Perspectives. And here's Kelly.
So I'm going to read a few poems from my book, The Brightest Rock, and then I'll read some newer pieces. One of the things going on in this book is my transition from being married to being single in midlife and starting over again. So this poem is called The Marriage House. In the yard of the house that I lived in longer than I've ever lived anywhere, the clay reached deeper than I could dig. Excavation is so different from tunneling. What you dig up is lit by the sun, same as everything else. Pale centipedes burrowing in a flurry of legs. The spade leaves a slick wall of clay, all of a piece. Worm halves wriggling out, like Girl Scouts from tents on a chill, bright morning. We'd layer compost and leaves, mix and turn and plant. But if we didn't keep at it, that clay would rise back up and crack in the summer drought. I always imagined we could slice it, straight-sided, like bricks, dry them till they were hard enough to be mortared into something useful. That yard so small, the best use seemed to be just to leave that clay where it lay, impenetrable under everything we planted. This is a haiku. Beyond the window, a garden blooms in full sun, fly beating the glass. This poem, in Southwest England, are chalk hill figures you may have heard of. They are dug in through the turf into the, so the chalk shows underneath. There's white horses, and they're huge. They're massive on the side of these large hills, small mountains. And one of them is a human figure called the Cerne Giant, and that's the name of this poem. Dorset, England. Finally, the caption, looking up the axis of the giant's phallus, resolves this photograph of white lines on grass into the midsection of a man, his figure trenched into a chalk hillside. At midsummer, that axis aims straight at the rising sun. One hand grips a raised club. For centuries, he's been held here by turf cutters who keep the trench in the chalk open. They covered him during the war to keep bombers from reading his map. His great mark on the land awakens a memory of the Ring of Brogar far to the north. Its huge wheel of stones inscribes the sky over the rolling turf of its island. They'd be matchsticks to this giant in the south. I remember walking a path worn through the heather within that stone circle, and by halfway round, as if drawn up by my steps, another ring rises from the moor, surrounding me in currents of light, of song almost heard, whirling faster, faster than my humming bones ever could alone, wreathing the thinness of the place and its solid grip on my moving body. I'd be there still, would not have broken that circle for the world, but it slipped away when my child called me to the car, my family waiting for me to take my place. And I turned, walking easily between two rocks. At home with this book, old Orkney still arcs and loops within me. If my feet could trace the body of this Cerne giant from his ankle to his hip, shoulder, head, down his other side and up again, what might arise from the chalk on stout legs, inhabit its vast perimeter, lift one grassy hand? What of his life would I carry with me, tall as the very hill? And this is the last one from this book. It's about a coat, but it is called Why I Am Not an Evangelist. I am a person of faith, but evangelism is not my jam. And this poem sort of tells you why. I bought the vintage Pendleton man coat because it could button over my belly and breasts, and for its flannel pockets, a godsend when weather demands a heavy coat. Lined with satin, it's just as easy to slip out of as slip into. Its sleeves are short enough to stay out of my way and long enough to tuck over gloves, keeping the chill from the pulse at my wrists. The wide collar folds up around my cheeks when it's raw out. In this coat, there is room enough for all of me. It's heavy, though I don't often notice. It rides my shoulders or over my arm like no big deal. And bulky. This woolen coat won't be simply tossed on a bench or across a chair. Big as a man it is, and just as hard to ignore. How could I say to anyone, this is just the coat for you? Most coat racks cannot bear it. Okay, the other poems I'm going to read are from the manuscript for my next book, which is seeking a publisher. The book is called Straddling the Rift Zone, and a rift zone is where two tectonic plates are pulling apart. A famous one is the Atlantic Trench under the ocean. It's quite deep. And it's kind of about our place on this earth, from large scale up to the universe, down to a small scale of family, domicile, even DNA. And in those frames, what we do or don't care for, how we do or don't belong. So this first one is called Orchid Aria. The Indonesian bee orchid sings with flaming tongue. My hostess apologizes for the hair she lost to chemo. For 100 miles, a cicada clung to my car's back window. I stopped at dusk for gas, and she's gone now. Overcome by fumes? The chemists who distill what fills our tanks and shelves don't know or don't speak up. We trust in antioxidants, rely on red wine in moderation, learn to wear respirators to muck and gut homes flooded by worsening storms. I can barely hear this orchid's song. It is thin, in the key of C minor, citrus with a shadow. And it's an election season, so I'm going to read this poem. It includes the phrase empty sound, which the image is of a large body of water, in this case Pimlico Sound, but it also has other meanings. And it's in three parts. Prayer for Solid Ground, January 2017. The memory isn't old enough. Its ragged edges still seep. With just a fat needle and yarn the color of sunrise, I could stitch a hieroglyphic scar, tale of omen, masquerade, and fate. Black fades to light, white snow blackens. An earthquake liquefies solid ground, viscous, sliding, sucking. How could we, students of Earth, have so misunderstood the marsh? Moving from mound to hillock, our steps lengthened, water deepened, the dunes suddenly a mile behind. Ahead, the empty sound. Once we accept the muck in our shoes, it is simple to sit on a hummock and rest, sinking slowly like the sun. And this poem is from one of my favorite places in Oregon. It's called Against Playing It Safe, Astoria, Oregon. Were a fish head to slip from slick dock and cormorant miss it, tide so low, marina nearly sandbarred shut. Flesh wouldn't sink far, feeding crab, prawn, bottom crawlers. Were a woman's shoelace inadvisedly long, and she musing on the food web, what might barnacles rip? Instead, watching her step against loose lace, rotten board, breach, there is no view. No bridge, no freighter, no ridge-climbing clapboard, no tangle of birds at the tide-splitting current that tastes of the far interior, wheat, mint, fur. This next one is It was written in 2020, which was a year. Especially here, one of the things that happened was massive fires. My house was in a level one evacuation zone and covered with orange smoke. And the epigraph is a line from the book of Job in the Hebrew scriptures or Christian Old Testament. The poem is called Grieving Year. And the epigraph is, I will speak the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Job 7, verse 11. Even the lamentations are different now, multiplied, polyphonic. The lamentation of fire trucks mustered from far districts counterpoints the heave and suck of ventilators in worldwide chorus. A lamentation of blackberries, abundant, sweet, picked on walks during phone calls with elderly parents, so they'll exercise too. They circle a backyard through lamentations of dying redbud, rock-hard peaches. Protesters lament police killings, federal enforcers fire less fatal ammunition, night after night lob canisters of a tear gas too dangerous for more than one exposure. Our sewers embrace lamentations of chemicals, and no one can say how they'll harm scarce salmon, trees, fetuses, whether justice will breathe again. Lamentations of weddings canceled or masked and moved online, distant from loved ones. Lamentations of families blocked from collective lamentation. They must grieve apart. And this one is after a poem by the Polish poet Wisława Szymborska, who I learned about when she won the Nobel in the 90s, and she's one of my favorite poets. The poem of hers I was following is called On Death, and mine is called On Control. Control cannot lend a hand, shuffle cards, listen to the person crowding its seat on the bus, knows nothing about learning, playing jazz, diving for whale song. Planning for the unexpected, control completely misses the point. Oh, it can clear-cut Edens in both hemispheres, shoot bullets, and bloody its own people the world over. Dependent on our submission, control resorts to forcing us out. But it cannot silence the poets harmonizing like a gospel choir. Whether an unsubdued great ants reveal the lie at its core, control is never more than fleeting in a universe born from an instant of explosive abandon. One more poem? Okay, I'm going to close with a poem in tribute to my dad, who's about to enter hospice care, joining my mother in hospice care. But they got to celebrate their 70th anniversary this year. So, and there's an image in here where I'm imagining inhabiting my shadow as it moves across the landscape. In the painted hills, too far away, near Mitchell, Oregon. What exactly is gone when Dad, faced with chicken, tortilla, salsa, and cheese, no longer knows how to make them be taco? Sun sinks. Painlessly, I crawl, a shadow, up ochre slopes. Spring wind cold out of the east haunts my ears. Soundlessly I fall into a hidden valley, emerge a breath later, cresting the next hill's memory of grass. Just before dark, I ascend rust-red layers of swamp rock, slip unseen down their lightless side, thankful for a sister with him who knows he likes cheese first, then warm meat. His waiting hand, his pleasure, easy now. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. And now I'm going to throw in a poem from Diane Seuss's new book, Modern Poetry. I strongly recommend her previous book, Frank Sonnets. And this poem is called Poetry. There's no sense in telling you my particular troubles. You have yours too. Is there value in comparing notes? Unlike Williams writing poems on prescription pads between patients, I have no prescriptions for you. I'm more interested in the particular nature and tenor of the energy of our trouble. Maybe that's not enough for you. Sometimes I stick in some music. I'm capable of hallucinations, so there's nothing wrong with my images. I'm not looking for wisdom. The wise don't often write wisely, do they? The danger is on teetering into platitudes. Maybe Keats was preternaturally wise, but what he gave us was beauty, whatever that is, and truth, synonymous, he wrote, with beauty, and not the same as wisdom. Maybe truth is the raw material of wisdom before it has been conformed by ego, fear, and time, like a shot of whiskey without embellishment, or truth lays bare the broken house and wisdom scurries in, wanting to cover and justify it. It's really kind of a nasty enterprise. Who wants anyone else's hands on their pain? And I'd rather be arrested than advised, even on my taxes. So what can poetry be now? Dangerous to approach such a question, and difficult to find the will to care. But we must not languish, soldiers. We must go so far as to invent new mechanisms of caring. Maybe truth, yes, delivered with clarity. The tone is up to you. Truth, unabridged, has become in itself a strange and beautiful thing. Truth may involve a degree of seeing through time, even developing a relationship with a thing before writing, whether a bird or an idea about birds, it doesn't matter. But please, not only a picture of a bird. Err on the side of humility, though humility can be declarative. It does not submit. It can even appear audacious. It takes metal to propose truth and pretend it is generalizable. Truth should sting in its way, like a major bee, not a sweat bee. It may target the reader like an arrow or be swallowable. A watermelon seed we feared as children would take up residency in our guts and grow unabated and change us forever into something viney and prolific and terrible. As for beauty, a problematic word, one to be side-eyed lest it turn you to stone or salt, it is not something to work on, but a byproduct, at times, of the process of our making. Beauty comes or it doesn't, as do its equally compelling counterparts in elegance and vileness. This we learn from Baudelaire, Flaubert, Rimbaud, Genet, male writers of the lavishly grotesque. You've seen their rooms, the red velvet walls and lampshades fringed gold, cat hair thick on the couches, and you have been wearily compelled, even cushioned by them. Either way, don't tell me flowers are beautiful and blood clots are ugly. These things I know, or I know this is how flowers and blood clots are assessed by those content with stale orthodoxies. Maybe there is such a thing as the beauty of drawing near. Near, nearer, all the way to the bedside of the dying world, to sit and witness, without platitudes, no matter the distortions of the death throes, no matter the awful music of the rattle, close, closer to that sheeted edge. From this vantage point, poetry can still be beautiful. It can even be valuable, though never wise. Diane Seuss. Next up is Denine Berglund. Denine is reading today from her first book of poems, The Goodbye Kit, which will be released in September, next month, from Airlie Press. She's been a recipient of a poetry fellowship from Oregon Literary Arts, and her writing has appeared in several journals and books, including Propeller Magazine, the Cincinnati Review, Tahoma Literary Review, Denver Quarterly, and Alive at the Center. She teaches at Portland State University. Deneen will also be reading from her book Sunday, September 15th at 5 p.m. at the Rose City Book Pub, and October 8th with Irene Cooper at Broadway Books.
Animals invaluable to epidemiologists for tracking the spread of disease will appear to us as angels. These will be among the signs there's no going back. A string of disembodied wings at your feet form a path. Soap operas start going off the air. Words like heretofore rejoin the lexicon. Bedbugs make an epic comeback. Suddenly, your taste for meat seems too carnal. You find this all heartbreaking, so you might make a list of things you can fit in the palm of a hand. Tennis ball, testicle, tarot deck, tiny bat you can look straight in the teeth. He's a little leather pouch of fear. He could be carrying a disease or a message about the sovereignty of flesh. Do you think we are the stars of animals' anxiety dreams? A body is just a place to keep your guts safe. You can feel small if that makes you feel better. The carcasses will still sigh their breath of flies. The wolves sing the same shivered chord as the trains, as mosquitoes form clouds of lullabies over the plains. Music has always been good for sad things. Just ask the birds. If you've never been full of eggs, you wouldn't understand. Okay, this one is called Angiospermaphrodite. And some of the poems in this book, a lot of the poems in this book, play around with the ideas of intimacy and marriage, and but also thinking about our relationship as humans to nature. And so this poem sort of imagines, what if the binary of gender were actually people and plants? So, Angiospermaphrodite. The world began and there were two genders, plants and people, with no common language, only squirrels and bees. Before hope for wings settled for seeds, the trees found their faces lidded and lashed, and we lay down together in our dirt nests. After, even the bees took sides, honey or sweat. Why salt the vegetables? It won't bring them back. But the memory of armpits in the broken rhubarb. Once I lost my fear of yellow jackets, plums ripened. I pressed the puckered bottom against my lips. What disappointing flesh. The bitter skin, first and last of what's in my mouth. Commune. A wolf once waited beside your grave for your hand to touch his forehead just above the embers of his eyes. God's voice back then was a box of wasps. Do you remember singing in the choir? How your voice became an ache at the root? Tonight, a pack tunes up in a snowy place. A dog lifts its head from the curve of its tail to smell the swelling sound heavy as a breast. Have you ever danced with a stranger? At each point where your bodies meet, you press to say, "I'm going there. Please come too." It is human to be swallowed by 100 voices, to be many beings lonely at once. Wedding prayer. I will make myself a husband and rest my head on the lion's tongue. With this fence, I thee wed, the deer tail twitching in her bed of blood-stained leaves. Let this make us safe to kiss and wake in the bright light of science. Let us place too much stock in our own resilience. Let us experiment. Let us embrace and make pets of our differences. Dear orcas who can see all the way inside our guts, dear mice who kill snakes too cold to fight, no one is safe in nature. Let us live there together, distracted as feral bees untethered from their keeper. Our work is better when we're kept. Let us be needy and also full. A crown of kinglets ringing the suet. Let us forget. All right. This one is called Stories About Horses Always End in a Race. I was recently in Costa Rica and I went horseback riding with my daughter, and there's something about horses and little girls, and this poem is sort of about that. Girls learn about kissing from horses, lips soft as flower, the tricky teeth. Girls don't notice horses' eyes look eternally as though someone were speaking to them urgently in a foreign language they haven't quite given up trying to understand. Why should anything need to run that fast? All night, girls dream of being kissed on the palms of their hands. All right, this one's called Hello, Junk. It's nights like these we bump in outer space like slow buses fishtailing on black ice. Unlike the many I've discarded for no good reason, you deep sixed the cell phone in the compost, and I knew that I should keep an eye on you. Luckily, I like to reconnoiter. On second thought, I'll just keep this candle burning on the altar of things I let slide like planks of rusty snow slipping from a wheel well. The sound of wind ruffling a stack of unanswered mail is akin to the sound my dreams make when you enter them, a thing seldom noticed until the engine drops out. Nevertheless, my memory as broken down jalopy makes more sense when I consider the watchdog of your happiness and his stubborn silence on windswept nights. I don't exactly understand the math of how or why you were mislaid, any more than I can grapple with the economy or Jesus dying to forgive my sins. Only that a man once explained sleep and deprivation as a room with two chutes, coal dumping in from one while I was shoveling out the other. It's a wonder I don't wake up black and coughing. My punishment is to miss any news of you, your woozy whispered secrets, to stand outside the frosted window lighting matches. Fact is, a heart-shaped clock is no stand-in. Check my chest cavity. Listen, I am standing at the door crack. The light from your side is cutting me in half. So this book is called The Goodbye Kit. And as you might imagine, a lot of the poems are about things going away, things changing, you know, growing up, growing apart. And then, of course, this underlying sense of things changing in terms of climate change and how that impacts the way we feel about our relationships and our kids. This one is called Scape and Shudder. Mice, specifically a mouse eating a donut. Then more childhood accidents. The realization of bones, the penetrable skin of frogs and milk. God made sense for a few minutes, but the bees made more. Their fragile, complicated dancing reminded us of love, which we thought of as constant, the sure, warm place under a tongue, but it wasn't. We were over and over kicked out of that wilderness. Grass was a sleeping giant, and the birds always leaving sometimes stop to cheer us on their way to getting lost in the mirrors of buildings. How the world distracted us, too, with constant offers. Occasionally came back to the mouse, not wild, not tame, domestic as a potholder. There was nothing to worry about. Everything terrible had already happened to other people. God tried to make explanations in his language of carbon and birdsong. All the while, the unfinished business of discovery, fingertips perched on their tiny platforms, each print pressed flat as a moth on glass. The sense of loss when we missed the soft pleasure of erasers. So we made artifacts more permanent than rocks and threw them away and away. Children were born, each with a twiggy nest of questions chirping inside her. They palmed the perfect heft of apples and pictured their own bright hearts bruising. We couldn't imagine being able to love them enough, so we placed lenses over our eyes to look. Exit strategy. Let's meet where it is always someone's birthday. Cake is great for morale. We'll tell each other bedtime stories of celebrity exploits, of news of yet another island. We'll call it Mars. I hear they are selling only one-way tickets, that the equator is a lot like Norway, but without the fish. Let's imagine our bodies vaulted against the stars as our bones turn to jam. In the movie, you can play yourself. Our daughter will make up the theme song and sing it in her pajamas. Terrible things will happen. Parking garages pulled out like wisdom teeth and barrels of soy sauce discharged out to sea. It will be a relief each time you lose what you can bear to lose. But the end of the world will smell like Cheerios whispered on a four-year-old's breath. So let's spend this long grief waiting to finally fuck up beyond repair this gorgeous machine. It is what we were born to do. We listen to the weather's incessant bark, a background panic we screen out like any other pet peeve. You say you think nature's just lonesome for my company. But here I am again, my face lit up by my own personal spotlight. Oh, darling. How we ripen. How else would you find me in this dark? All right, I'm going to read one more. This is the title poem. It's the last poem in the book. And it's called The Goodbye Kit. Don't forget the heirloom tomatoes. Don't forget the tragic book of matches. Truth is, I'd rather like to be ancestral. Dying is just par for the course. It's the other blotting out that bothers. It's those daughters on the honor roll. No need for maps now, or cats, or panic. Forget the albums of each twilight image. Whatever you do, resist the urge to toss a fish in. Let the cabbages cup their hands in prayer. God can get back to his long nap, his holy absence that sounds like turtles overturned and pedaling. As time moves on, we'll wonder if that fish meant love or evolution as we fell deeper into God's bottomless dread where once there had been bottomless desire. Someday we'll be able to look back anthropologically and laugh. But it's time we were affecting sad accents and packing our capsules. Time to cover the mirrors. Time to tuck in your feathers. Time to relinquish all your plastics and let the sea fill. Nothing's calmer than a husk. It's soft brush with breath.
Thanks, Nadine. As you might have guessed, I kind of put this show together on the fly. The three readers are pre-recorded and never know quite how time will work out, so I'm going to hedge a little bit and launch right into reader number three, Michael Keefe. He's a novelist, not a poet. Well, maybe he writes poetry too, but he's reading from his novel today. all her loved ones, Encoded, which just came out this year from Running Wild Press, and he has a forthcoming collection, Western Terminus Stories and a Novella, from Cornerstone Press, coming next year. He is the events coordinator and publicist at Annie Bloom's Books, an independent bookstore, yay, in Portland, Oregon, where he lives with his wife, the author Liz Prado, and their two cats. His website is Michael Keefe Author at WordPress.com. And here's Michael. Oh, yeah, Michael wanted you to know that his novel, which he's about to read from, All the Loved Ones Encoded, is a story of personal struggle set against global climate collapse as one woman risks everything in order to preserve her family. Here's Michael.
I'm going to read to you from Chapter 4 of All Her Loved Ones Encoded. The main storyline takes place in 2057, and the protagonist is Kiana Olson. Here in Chapter 4, the protagonist is her mother, Ellen. Chapter 4, October 2040. Ellen fell back from her daughter's side, slowing her pace while she peeled off her orange hoodie. A faint breeze carried the zest of salt water up from the bay to the footpath that wound along the cliff. Santa Cruz afternoon was cloudy and cool, but the mile-long walk from Pacific Garden Mall had warmed her up. Just the other day, Ellen read that the average global surface temperature had risen 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 20 years, the same amount of time that elapsed since she gave birth to Kiana, a nearly catastrophic surge of heat. By the time Ellen had tied the hoodie around her waist, Kiana's golden-brown ponytail was bouncing just ahead on the path. Ellen hurried her stride to catch up. She resumed her spot alongside Kiana, walking to her daughter's left so that Ellen could listen with her good right ear. This adaptation went back to childhood and a bout of meningitis. Ellen had met Kiana in town a couple of hours after riding the bus down from her mountain home. Kiana had bussed over the hills from San Jose. They'd had lunch at a food cart, then browsed for a while at Bookshop Santa Cruz, where neither woman had committed to a purchase. Ellen got all her reading material from the library. Kiana was a scholarship student at San Jose State and worked part-time at Best Buy, which didn't leave her much disposable income. Whose income was disposable nowadays? Not Ellen's. She worked part-time doing accounting for the Bear Claw Cafe, the coffee shop down the road from her house. The Korean barbecue tofu wrap she'd bought for lunch was a luxury, and spending the afternoon in town constituted a major outing for Ellen. She didn't like to stray away from her comfort zone. She'd spent the last 20 years avoiding being seen. But she relished the opportunity to have her daughter all to herself. Mostly Kiana came to the small house for visits. And, inevitably, Alex would emerge from the big house and insert herself into their company. It was only natural that she would do so. Aunt Alex had been a constant presence in Kiana's life since day one. Ellen hated feeling resentful toward Alex, who really was like a sister to her. Even if, maybe, probably, Alex had always hoped for a different kind of bond between them. So, after next quarter, Kiana was saying, I should have enough credits to complete my history minor. Oh? Helen thought Kiana had stopped taking history classes after changing majors sophomore year. She had lobbied hard to convince Kiana that electronics engineering was far more practical and would open up more career opportunities. They'd argued a lot. Thanksgiving that year had been fraught, but the world was fraught, and it wasn't getting any easier to support oneself. Ellen had once chosen a narrow path for herself, and she'd spent the last 2 decades living as a hermit. That's right, I'd forgotten you'd kept that up. Was that a sigh from Kiana, or a normal exhale? They were walking at a good clip along West Cliff Drive, or what remained of it. Ellen could remember when cars still drove that scenic road. Over the last decade, the rising ocean's relentless erosion of the cliff wall had eaten away large chunks of asphalt, along with the foundations for some of the most valuable properties in Santa Cruz. Now an ugly concrete barricade interrupted views of the Pacific world below. The boardwalk, the wharf, the surfers in their wetsuits, the murky horizon. In another decade, she supposed, the path they walked on now will have washed away too. So, the history class I'm taking this term? Kiana turned her head toward her mother. A pointed gesture, Ellen knew that particular angling of her daughter's eyebrows. A test. Are you going to listen to me, or are you going to judge me? Yes, tell me. It's pretty cool. Do you know the video game Level Up? Just ahead, a cop strode quickly around the corner, a husky guy stuffed into a dark blue uniform. He came toward them on the path, head lowered to read whatever message was being transmitted to his watch. A staticky voice leaked from his earbud, the transmission tinny and indistinct from that distance. Ellen's nerves pulsed, a million tiny alarms. She pushed her sunglasses up her nose. She reached for the brim of a cap she wasn't wearing. Damn it. She'd left herself exposed, too easily recognizable. She'd gotten lax. Her hair had grown back out, the hair she'd once hastily chopped off in Alex's guest bathroom, her first night on the lam. And she had long ago stopped dyeing it the cranberry red that had once marked her transformation from wanted criminal Taylor Ellen Olson to a new woman without a past, Ellen Taylor. As the cop drew nearer, blood revved through her body. She dropped behind Kiana, single file, even though the path was plenty wide enough for the cop to pass. "Copy that. On my way." The cop clicked his watch and broke into a shuffling jog. As he passed Ellen, his gaze remained on the path ahead. Ellen returned to her daughter's side. For several seconds, neither spoke. "Mom." "Level up. I heard you." "No. Okay, yeah. But what was that just now?" Kiana smirked. "You don't honestly think, after all these years, that some beat cop is going to recognize you and..." "Force of habit, all right," Ellen sighed. For the last several years now, she'd been asking herself the same question. Was she being paranoid or appropriately cautious? Was her image among those whom the FBI and the NSA automatically checked against video footage collated from CCTV cameras, police body cams, and surveillance footage of protest gatherings? Or had the authorities abandoned her case long ago? "I mean, the gray alone," Kiana said. With a wry smile, she swept her fingertips through Ellen's hair. "Yeah, yeah," she batted away Kiana's hand. "Stop being mean to your elderly mother." "Elderly?" Kiana snorted a laugh. "Sure thing, Mom. You're like, what, 45? "Yep." Ellen was 46, but why quibble? She was glad to know her daughter didn't think of her as old yet. But 50 was approaching rapidly. A blip later, she'd be 60. And another blip, a senile and shriveled thing, stashed away in a nursing home, some poor stranger mopping up her drool. She couldn't imagine a more horrifying end. "So anyway," Kiana said, "Level Up is virtual reality, world-building software. The basic idea is you create an avatar of yourself and a cool place to live, somewhere awesome, hot lover, whatever. The world is your oyster, and the world of Level Up is way better than this one, right? Climate's great, everyone's employed, etc. Makes sense. A virtual world would have to offer an improvement to appeal to anyone with common sense. Although, back in her youth, plenty of boys Ellen knew had played those first-person shooter games that took place in seedy underworlds and wartime hellscapes. Some people just enjoyed wallowing in shit. But what does this video game have to do with history? Okay, good question. The software for Level Up is so good at recreating houses, neighborhoods, entire cities. It's so realistic that historians have started using it to recreate places from the past. For example, the Battle of Gettysburg or daily life in colonial Rio de Janeiro. Those examples being two of my classmates' projects. Ellen nodded. "And what's your project?" "Right, so, yeah." Kiana's voice turned circumspect. She stared down at her sneakers while she walked. "My project is the Beacon Hill neighborhood of Seattle in the 1970s. "I see." That's when and where Ellen's mother grew up, Lindsay Zelenko, daughter of habitually unemployed airline mechanic and chronic gambler Harry, and emotionally absent Patty. It wasn't just history Kiana was investigating, but family history. Ellen's least favorite history. She hadn't spoken to any of her relatives since Kiana was born. Occasionally, she searched for news online. That's how she discovered that her mom had died 3 years ago now. Her father, Greg Olson, appeared to remain among the living. The year Kiana turned 16, Ellen had finally relented to her daughter's incessant pleas and presented her with a list of names. Along with the identities of Kiana's grandparents, those of her great-grandparents, Frank Olson and Ilsa Schmidt, Harry Zelenko and Beverly Wallace, also the name of Kiana's father, Sam Mahai. Ellen had stipulated that, should Kiana reach out to any of these people, she wasn't permitted to reveal the current whereabouts of Taylor Ellen Olson. She'd also made clear that she didn't want to know whatever news Kiana might discover. Ellen didn't exactly hate her father or anyone from her family of origin, but she had cut herself off from her former life completely, and she didn't believe in looking back. The past and the present became volatile when mixed. All that mattered was here and now. As for history, Ellen didn't see any value in it. Just a small section of Seattle, Kiana was saying, between Beacon Avenue and the interstate. The toughest part is the names of businesses, what certain buildings look like prior to remodeling or demolition. But Level Up is amazing at synthesizing various sources of information. Scans of old photos, digitized video footage, text from newspaper articles, and converting that data into city blocks and landscapes. And my project is part of a global collaborative effort. Open source, shared knowledge. To get credit in class, I just have to add a few new, well-researched elements myself. Which is fair, but tricky, of course. Kiana was babbling, a nervous habit Ellen had witnessed time and again. Her chest cramped with guilt. She'd been dismissive of her daughter's passion project. Well, that all sounds really cool, honey. It is pretty incredible. The path angled toward the west. As Kiana turned her head to speak, the hazy sun caused her to squint. I can put on a pair of VR glasses and, like, walk around Cold War Berlin, only without the foul smells and dank air. Well, Ellen said, maybe they'll add that later, like with the Feelies in Brave New World. Oh, right. I remember that seemed kind of creepy in the novel. Kiana shrugged her typical change of subject shrug, and Ellen heard the words, "So anyway," a moment before her daughter spoke them. "So anyway, this project got me thinking about my last name. How Taylor is only my last name because you changed your last name. But Taylor doesn't say anything about where I come from, you know?" This is true. And just as well, it seemed to Ellen. "So I was thinking of changing my last name to Olson. Maybe after I graduate? To honor my heritage. I mean, if that feels okay to you, Mom?" Possible replies in the form of questions piled up in Ellen's tongue. Why Olson and why not Mahai? Why not Zelenko, Schmidt, or Wallace? Had Kiana spoken to Ellen's father, met him in person? If so, had Kiana's conversation with Greg Olson somehow inspired her choice of surnames? And did that mean the man had changed? Or had tales of some elder Olson led to Kiana's decision? Ellen herself had always admired her grandfather Frank and his father Einar. Ellen swallowed all the questions down. It didn't matter. And, she reminded herself, she didn't want to know. "Sure, honey, of course." She forced a smile. "It sounds important to you, so that's what you should do." "Thanks, Mom." Kiana wrapped her fingers around Ellen's forearm, gave a squeeze. They walked in silence for a while, a comfortable quietude. Though Ellen didn't really believe in New Age stuff like auras or energy fields, some detectable atmospheric shift had occurred just now between her and Kiana, an ease that only sometimes manifested itself between their bodies, two bodies that had once felt to her like a single body. Not so long ago, only 20 years, two decades in which everything had deteriorated. Ellen's knees, the plumbing at the Bear Claw, the cliff on which she walked, civility in America, the value of the dollar, species diversity across the planet. Shit, did anything change for the better? Okay, yes, one thing did, her daughter. Kiana had grown into a healthy and intelligent woman. Her young mind continued to expand, to welcome new philosophies. If one of those philosophies included her family of origin, then maybe the ground shook. Violent and sudden, an explosion? Earthquake! Kiana grabbed Ellen's wrist and pulled her off the path. They stumbled into a vacant lot, overgrown with grass. Ellen's every other footstep seemed to miss the earth, then her next landed with a jarring stamp. Before them stood the crumbled remains of a bulldozed house. Why were they running toward that house? Nothing made sense. One thudding step later, Ellen understood. Kiana was leading her away from danger, away from their eroding cliff, away from the overhead power lines that draped along the dying palms, into an open space. After a lifetime in California, Ellen should have known what to do, but the rumbling earth, it blanked her mind completely every goddamn time. They stopped before the ruins of the house and wrapped their arms around one another. A terrible sound, sharp yet deep, a sundering sound, made Ellen jump. Her heartbeat flew, her breath cinched tight. The earth was splitting. The end had come. "Wow, look," Kiana said. She lifted an arm from their embrace and pointed a place where a section of the concrete barrier had cracked in two. "Oh," Helen said. Then she realized the trembling had ceased. Another ordinary California quake. Sudden tumult, some damage here and there, and then it's over. And yet, when caught in the middle of it, the primal fear struck her every time. This was the end, the final cleaving of the San Andreas, and that singular fear conjured others. Some great annihilating event always loomed just over the horizon. The flood that breached the seawalls, nationwide total blackout, another global pandemic, nuclear catastrophe, the world engulfed in flames. These terrible endings formed a knot in Ellen's chest. She held tightly to Kiana, to the life she had created. From the day her daughter was born, Ellen never should have let her go. She desperately wanted never to let her go again. A moment later, Kiana peeled away as easily as shedding an unneeded hoodie. She turned to Ellen, mouth slack and hazel eyes wide. Well, that was scary. Ellen stood there, staring mutely at her daughter. Mm-hmm, she finally managed. Just by muttering those syllables, she began to relax. The surrounding world opened back up to her. She heard the sound of crashing waves, felt the warmth of the sun. Only now did she realize that a scattering of tents lay pitched across the vacant lot. People had emerged from the soiled nylon flaps. Scruffy beards, brittle hair, frayed clothes, faces smudged with grime. More and more people went homeless every year. And herein, she and Kiana stood, in a place these people had staked for themselves. Ellen felt like a spectacle. She needed to get out of that not-so-vacant lot, to escape hectic Santa Cruz, to slink back up to her little house in the woods. She tugged at Kiana's sleeve, then started walking back toward the path, toward the bus that would ferry her back up the mountain. Kiana fell in step alongside her. "Hey, Mom, would it be okay if I maybe spent the night at home tonight?" "Of course, honey. You're always welcome." Ellen's eyes dampened. Was she feeling sentimental, or was the shock from the quake wearing off? Maybe both. At that moment, nothing sounded better to Ellen than a simple meal at home with her daughter, and Alex too. "Always?" Kiana asked. A sly grin squeezed into the corners of her lips. "Even after I changed my last name to Olson?" Ellen felt her lips stretch into a smile. The cinched-up knot in her chest loosened, just a touch more. "Yeah, even then."
Thanks, Michael. And to remind you that KBOO, which you're listening to, is community-sponsored and commercial-free, except for little things like this, asking you to give us a little money because we're very dependent on donations from listeners. You can go to the website, kboo.fm, and see how you can help. Looks like there's time to stick in another poem here, this one from Eileen Tabios, and it appeared in issue 5 of the wonderful and no longer with us Tin Fish magazine. This is their April 2000 issue out of Hawaii. Eileen Tabios, the controlling agent. The little boy squats so he can mimic an old man. A bird samples his bared knee before perching on his shoulder. Behind them, a sun sets and the wind stops gasping. Palm trees sway in the dusk, floating behind the pale river that ripples over cracked ochre pebbles. Perhaps something lurks in the river grass. Perhaps not. She picks up the ancient carved figurine of the boy perched atop a piece of bamboo. Around the bamboo, a frieze of a river scene winds itself. Her finger traces the boy's tiny but plump cheeks, then the bird on his shoulder. She notices the bird has lifted one wing, as if about to fly away. She had thought this carven thing would be a toy for her nephew, but upon closer inspection, she foretells accurately it would be a source of nightmare. Yet she takes it, dropping virgin bills in the wizened shopkeeper's palm. The old woman barks briefly at her choice, then turns away to clear her throat or pretend to do so. She likes to collect ghosts, you see, for the illusion she owns, the years she knows she still must peel through. Increasingly, she has become afflicted with feelings of uncertainty about what lies beyond the perimeter of her sight. Like who had the ability long ago to look at a boy playing by a passive, was it not passive, river, and recognize a bird about to take flight? Oh, my love, who is subject and who is observer? What if the bird was perfectly content to stay with the boy? What if the observer is the controlling agent? That's Eileen Tabios, Again, I always end my shows with gratitude because there's a lot to be thankful for. First, to tonight's featured readers, Kelly Lennox, Deneen Berglund, and Michael Keefe. Thanks to KBOO for existing and to all who support it. That's you. Thanks to Talking Earth founders Barbara Lamorticello, Walt Curtis, and to Talking Earth's producer and host, Patrick Bocard. I'm Dan Raphael. Here are two true crow encounters. One, parked about a block from the music store, and in all 5 yards I passed were 4 or 5 scattered crow feathers, no larger piles, regular distribution, no bones, blood, or words. And the other one, as I walked down the business street, a crow circled close above me 4 times, brushed a wing against my cap. Was it the pastry I was eating, or some other message? Who is observing? Be careful, you can't change what you can't see. So take care. Good night.
David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.